The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Okay, bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt. It's Friday. Enjoy the day into the weekend. Friday, January 14th in the year of our Lord 2022. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live from the West Coast this morning and for many weeks ahead. The breaking news this morning as you wake up is that Ukraine is under a massive cyber attack. Reading from the Financial Times. On Friday morning, targets included websites of the ministerial cabinet, the foreign education, agriculture, energy, emergency, energy, Veterans Affairs, and Environment Ministries. Also out of service were the websites of the State Treasury and the Electronic Public Services platform, where vaccination certificates and electronic passports are stored. Hackers are attempting to make it look like it is Russian, Polish nationalists attacking. Of course, it's Russia doing what has long been expected as a prelude to the actual invasion, proving yet again that when you want things to go south, you send Deputy Secretary Wendy Sherman to oversee negotiations. A second foreign story leading news this morning. Another series of parties at number 10 as Boris Johnson sinks into the swamp of his own and his staff's foolishness. A booze run to fill a suitcase with wine. The full story of our exclusive on those Downing Street parties. On the night before Prince Philip's funeral, when the entire country was in official mourning and the Queen sat alone in the chapel at Windsor, they were drinking it up into the wee hours of the night at number 10 where Boris Johnson lives. I don't know how he gets out of this. He probably ought to just quit today. It's going to keep going because obviously no one had a sense of decency at all or a sense of a hypocrisy meter that they were ruining the lives and the mourning and the ability to function of the rest of the country, and yet they had unto themselves their own circle of privilege. They are Tories, but they're not really. They're hypocrites. They all ought to go. The big news in the United States, the Supreme Court struck down the workplace mandate. It upheld the mandate for healthcare workers, but if you listen to this show, you knew that was coming because it is, in fact, the spending clause at work. It's not a surprise. I called this completely right. I thought they might get Justice Kagan on the overreach by OSHA, because it's just an absurd rule. You know, OSHA was not invented to deal with pandemics. They have no authority. The court laughed at them. 6-3 decision, though, striking down the workplace mandate. As I said, mandates belong to governors, owners of private businesses that are not bound by collective bargaining agreements. The president, in his capacity as commander-in-chief and lead of the executive branch, he can't order Congress to do anything. He cannot order the courts to do anything. He cannot order any private business to do anything about vaccines or mandates. And he got slapped down. And what's unfortunate is, honestly, any student who took my law in the last 25 years who took my con law class would have known this was coming. The president expressed dismay, but the president expressed a lot of odd stuff yesterday. The CDC, by the way, is letting its rules expire for cruise ships. Proving that, once again, nobody trusts the CDC because everybody knows the one place you don't want to be right now is on a cruise ship. That'll pass. I still fully expect to go on a cruise in May and in Europe, but in April, I mean. But right now, they're letting it because they're the least skilled group of people I've ever seen when it comes to running a bureaucracy. The news from January 6th. Is that Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes has been charged with seditious conspiracy. I believe that's the first seditious conspiracy charge. There have been other conspiracy charges, but it might be the only seditious conspiracy charge. And I say, if he's guilty, in presumption of innocence, good. Good that they charged him. Good that they found him. Throw the book at him. If what the 48-page, 17-count indictment that came out just yesterday says that he was organizing a group of his followers to be armed and ready to assault the federal government, that is seditious conspiracy, they should go to jail for a long time. Biggest news? Well, there are two big pieces of news. Kristen's, it's not news, but maybe somebody on the left will finally figure out. Kristen Sinema said yesterday on the floor of the Senate, I'm not changing my mind. Joe Manchin said yesterday, I'm not changing my mind. And Kyrsten Sinema has not said one thing differently from the beginning. She said, I'm not breaking the filibuster. Joe Manchin has said one thing from the beginning. I'm not breaking the filibuster. This is a deeply embarrassing end of the theater politics we've had while the country gets consumed by a ruinous inflation, as Ukraine prepares to be invaded by Russia, as China is taking over the South China Sea and has unleashed this vaccine, this virus, as the Biden administration has stumbled from faceplant to faceplant. People think their mean tweets are gone. Just remember that. Mean tweets are gone. You got your deal. Inflation, collapse abroad, Iran back, threatening Americans, about to have nuclear breakout, NATO in collapse, the economy in the tank, interest rates rising rapidly. But don't worry about it. Mean tweets are gone. Best news of the day. This isn't the biggest story of the day, but it's the best story of the day. And RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel will be joining me later in the show. I'm reading from the New York Times, which finally got the message, too. The Republican National Committee is preparing to change its rules to require presidential candidates seeking the party's nomination to sign a pledge to not participate in any debates sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. Republican committee officials alerted the debate commission of their plans in a letter sent yesterday, a copy of which was obtained by the New York Times. If the changes go forward, it would be one of the most substantial shifts in how presidential and vice presidential debates have been conducted since the commission began organizing debates more than 30 years ago. That's right. And over for 30 years, the commission has gone left, 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 just like the legacy media has gone left, left, left. And both the commission and the legacy media are arms of the Democratic National Committee, and the RNC has had it. The Democratic National Committee and the Presidential Debate Commissions threw the last election by canceling, by refusing to hold the first debate until more than, millions of debate votes, votes have been cast because of early voting. Then they unilaterally canceled the second debate without checking with the candidates. And that's exactly what Joe Biden wanted because he was running the basement campaign, the famous basement campaign. And it's been hiring left-wing moderators for decades. Now, when you got Dick Cheney sitting down with Joe Lieberman and pasting Joe Lieberman, it doesn't matter. When you've got George W. Bush crushing Al Gore because Al Gore is following him around like Lurch, it doesn't matter. But it matters in close things, and, you know, hand grenades and horseshoes and presidential debates are close run things. And that debate commission is partisan. It's run by octogenarians who will not give up. It's become a profit making organization. It has a huge staff that makes big salaries, that is above criticism and does not engage with their critics. It's time for it to go. And Ronna McDaniel will be joining us a little bit later to, in fact, announce it's gone. President Biden stumbled through a bunch of remarks yesterday. Let's play cut number two.
And to help lead our federal testing program, I've tapped Dr. Tom. I hope I pronounced Inglesby. Correct? Is that right, Jeff?
Yeah, is that right? He's on the prompter, by the way, at the White House. Cut number three.
Unfortunately, while our military is stepping up as they always do, there are others sitting on the sidelines, and we're standing in the way. If you haven't gotten vaccinated, do it. Personal choice impacts us all, our hospitals, our countries. I make a special appeal to social media companies and media outlets. Please deal with the misinformation and disinformation that's on your
show. Now we're trying to figure out why he's trying to set up a scapegoat for why his plans have collapsed. He's going to blame misinformation. Everybody knows. Go get vaccinated. Go get a booster. Be safe. Talk to people. There are breakout cases, yeah, but you're not going to die if you've had two vaccines and a booster. But I got to tell you, Nancy Pelosi obviously knows the bottom fell out yesterday, because here's what she said. Cut number eight.
Well, I stand with the president. I think that I thought his speech was wonderful, and I stand with him in the fight for voting rights. No criticism of Mr. Durbin. He has to do what he has to do vis-a-vis his own members and the rest. The only criticism I would make, too, I wouldn't say they're criticisms, but observations. Nobody knows who Bull Connor is. And if we're making
Nobody knows who Bull Connor is at all. No, not at all, Speaker. Oh, by the way, Steny Hoyer on MSNBC, cut number nine.
It wasn't so much he went too far. I think, you know, I know Bull Connor. I watched Bull Connor on television set dogs loose on six, seven, eight-year-old children, and I got really angry. So I know the Bull Connor reference.
But remember that nobody knows who Bull Connor is. Nobody. Look, Peggy Noonan's column in the Wall Street Journal today underscores the bottom fell out of Joe Biden, who was already at 33% approval in the Quinnipiac poll. His presidency is, in all intents and purposes, over. It is. It's over. He's done. Sinema and Manchin said, go away. They passed their $4 trillion worth of stimulus. That's it. That's done. And the Republicans are going to crush Democrats because people realize they've lost their collective minds. And good that the debate commission is buried 6 feet under as well. I'll be right back, America. It's Friday on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
I've got a feeling deep inside. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. I've got a feeling.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Betsy, Mrs. Hewitt, and I are finally watching The Beatles Get Back, directed by Peter Jackson. So we're a little behind the curve, but we were ahead of the curve. We saw Licorice Pizza before Sonny Bunch actually talked about it on the Hugh Hewitt Show. So we're actually ahead of the curve with Sonny Bunch. Sonny Bunch, of course, you can listen to him across the movie aisle pod or Bulwark Goes to the Movie or read his Washington Post reviews. He's the official movie critic of the Hugh Hewitt Show. We pay him in airline miles. Of course, he's very happy to come back every week at this hour. Good morning, Sonny. How are you?
I'm good, Hugh. How are you?
Good. Now, for Licorice Pizza, I'm an easy mark because I'm a junior in high school in the year that it's set. But I've been telling people who grew up in California in the Valley in 1973 that they're even easier marks for this. So tell me what the world who doesn't identify with the clothing and the music thinks of it.
Well, this is true. It's a little before my time. It's definitely not my part of the country in terms of growing up. But so Licorice Pizza is the new movie from Paul Thomas Anderson. Paul Thomas Anderson, of course, is the director of Boogie Nights, There Will Be Blood, Punch Drunk Love, Phantom Thread, a bunch of movies. It is set, as you say, in the early 1970s. In the valley of you know, just outside of L.A.
Encino. Encino.
In Encino, California. And it's kind of a rambling picture, right? It's not Altman-esque, right? Like his Magnolia was, or even. You know, as focused as Boogie Nights is on.
It's not nearly as fierce as Boogie Nights. It's much gentler.
No. Yeah. No, this is a gentler movie because it's about a 15-year-old, a guy named Gary, who's played by Cooper Hoffman, who is a young. He's a kid in high school. He's a child actor. He's kind of a hustler. He's out there, you know, starting PR firms and waterbed sales houses and pinball palaces as the movie goes on. And he is infatuated with a 25-year-old named Alana, played by Alana Haim. And this is this has been a point of contention among some viewers. They can't get over the age gap, the 15 and 25-year-old age gap. They think it's a little bit weird and a little bit creepy. And that's kind of understandable because the movie is largely about that age gap and how weird and awkward it is, and how two very different people can nevertheless be interested in and, changed by each other. But it's not, look, I want to be totally clear here. Again, age gap, very weird. But this is not a movie about a sexual relationship. I mean, it is a very chaste relationship these two have. You know, Alana basically finds herself sucked into the circle of weirdos that surrounds Gary and thinks it's weird herself. So there's a lot of interesting stuff here. The push and the pull of the film is, again, these two kind of coming to grips with their relationship and realizing the different ways in which they can hurt each other, despite, you know, not really being a couple. And it is the latest in Paul Thomas Anderson's series of romantic comedies, weird romantic comedies, let's call them. Punch Drunk Love being the first, which that stars Adam Sandler, comes out in 2002. And it is very much a deconstruction of the romantic comedy genre. It is like, it's a look at what life would be like in a romantic comedy if it was real. And the answer is it would be slightly terrifying.
But I got to tell you, Sonny, I'm going to give you my different take, get your take on this, which is if you lived through the 70s, it's after Vietnam and it's before disco. And in those 5 years, the culture oscillates wildly. And you've got Sean Penn playing William Holden. You've got Bradley Cooper playing John Peters. You've got Joel Wax coming out. I knew Joel pretty well. There is a period of time where after Vietnam ends and the culture settles down, it just gyrates and people go on amusement park rides. And so packed into this rambling wreck of a movie, because it goes everywhere, is just that general chaos. I thought the movie was chaotic because those 8 or 9 years until things settled down and Reagan arrived, it was just a gas line. It was just a weird time.
Yeah, it really is very much a slice of life. From the early 1970s. I mean, I think it's even before Vietnam ends, really. I mean, it's kind of the tail end there.
We're out by 72. This kid, no one's worried about getting drafted or killed. It's not the 60s.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the specter of Vietnam is really nowhere to be found in this movie.
Because it was over. We were out by 72. It didn't collapse until 75, but we were out by 72.
Yeah. As you say, it's a slice of life, and it is weird and rambling and awkward in the way that life is awkward. I mean,
yes.
You know, I've heard people complain like, oh, well, there's no real through line. It's very episodic, and it is. I mean, there is a through line. I would say the relationship is the through line, but it is episodic. But it's episodic in the way that life is episodic. It's episodic in the way that, you know, people don't have a kind of set path that they're on in their life. They do different things and they kind of do what comes next and are better off for it usually. So I like this movie a lot. I would say it's minor Paul Thomas Anderson. I don't think it's as good as There Will Be Blood.
Oh, it's not. I love this movie only because it's my life. And if you watch those teenagers not named Hoffman in it, that's what every teenager was doing.
Yeah.
Basically stupid stuff. Because there weren't any rules, and everybody was relieved that the war was over. Tell me what you think about young Hoffman, because I didn't realize he was Philip Seymour Hoffman's son until the end of the movie.
I thought he was very good. I mean,
so
I like both Cooper Hoffman and Alana Haim in this, and it's interesting because this is Alana's first movie. She's a singer, but she has never been an actress in a film before. And I thought she was really wonderful. I thought he's very wonderful. And they're both very good together. And it's interesting. I saw somebody else make this point, and it almost is mean to say, but it is, I think, accurate. Neither of them are, I would say, traditionally movie star attractive, right?
No, they're not.
Neither of them are. They are not, you know, Hollywood types. And there are Hollywood types in this movie. Sean Penn, who also is, like, not really traditionally Hollywood attractive, but also Bradley Cooper and some others. And like, there's a difference between the looks of these two people. And yet Paul Thomas Anderson, the way he films them and the way he, you know, the way the scenes are lit and the way the camera kind of lingers on them, but in a nice way without, I don't know how else to describe it. He makes them attractive. And
very charming
and pleasant
winsome. They are winsome.
Yeah.
Now talk to me about Sean Penn, because I thought a little brilliant. I don't particularly care for Sean Penn out of the screen, but he plays William Holt. That is a story within a story about the aging Hollywood actor reliving their glory days on the back lot. And I just thought it is an amazing vignette that they didn't have to put in there. Right. Got nothing to do with anything.
Well, right. Well, this is the thing, is that most of these vignettes have nothing to do with anything except for how Gary and Alana kind of are growing in their relationship. Right. So the scene with Sean Penn comes to town. He's auditioning actresses and Alana is going to be in his movie. And she is infatuated with him, and he barely notices her. And that is another, like, very true to life thing about Hollywood stardom, right? Is that
yes,
you really
yes.
need a specific person. You are just reflecting off of the adoration of, you know, whoever is in front of you. Tom Waits is also in this film. He plays the director who...
That was a brilliant... I don't know that actor. Tell me, he's brilliant. That was a hell of a role.
Great. Tom Waits is a singer, and he is infrequently an actor, but when he is in stuff, he is very, very good. He was... the last time I remember seeing him on screen was in the Coen Brothers' The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He plays one of the... He's in one of the segments.
Oh, okay.
The lead in one of the segments of that film. But he's very, very good. I like him a lot in this. I love Bradley Cooper in this.
He steals the movie, Sonny. And anyone who's of a certain age is going to say he steals the movie because John Peters was such a wreck of a man.
Yeah, I don't know anything about John Peters.
Kidding!
Before this movie started, I mean, I didn't really know anything about him. So I like looked him up later. Very interesting guy. At this point in the movie, he is dating Barbara Streisand.
Yes,
and he is clearly high out of his mind on cocaine most of the time. And
welcome to the 70s. Yep.
Yeah, I mean it's yeah, and Bradley Cooper is fantastic in this role. He's really, really wonderful. The performances in this movie are all great. Down to there's a blink and you'll miss it John C. Reilly appearance. I don't know if you
caught that. No. Where was he?
You really will hear him more than see him. He's playing Herman Munster.
Oh, yes. At the KidCom. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. So, but I mean, it's a really lovely movie. I quite like it. Again, I think it's minor. Paul Thomas Anderson. I don't think it's as good as There Will Be Blood, which is, you know, maybe the best movie of the 2000s. But very few things are as good as
it doesn't have Daniel Day-Lewis, so it's not going to be as good. But I am curious about whether or not you think these young people have acting futures, because there's a certain poignancy to their being in this movie, given Boogie Nights and Philip Seymour Hoffman's introduction as a rather, isn't that his big breakout movie where he plays the hapless in love with Mark Wahlberg guy?
Yes. That was probably his
almost famous as his
at that point. I think he had been in, had The Talented Mr. Ripley come out yet? I can't remember if that came out.
I can't remember. Almost Famous is after that, and that nails him down.
Almost Famous is after that. I mean, he had been in a few things before that. He was in, Scent of a Woman, right, and some other stuff. But I would say that Boogie Nights is definitely the movie where you're like, oh, okay. That's
he's talented.
This is a real talent.
Yeah.
I think Cooper Hoffman's great. I mean, look, it's hard to say with younger actors how their careers are going to shake out. In this movie, Gary is a child actor, and by the 30-minute mark, that's done. He's not doing child acting anymore.
The Lucille Ball character is terrific too. I mean, it's just. There's so much was ending and collapsing. The variety show was ending and collapsing, and the Seven is Enough and Family Affair. They were all ending and collapsing because the 60s were collapsing. I got to tell you, Sonny, have you written this up yet?
I have. I reviewed it last week, finally. I was like 3 weeks behind everybody else. I didn't see it until very, very recently. It's good. It's going to be in theaters for a while, probably.
Sonny, you're living through a period that film critics are going to study. It's going to be called the COVID film critic period, where nobody actually reviews anything at the right time.
Yeah, or sees anything at the right time.
Sonny Bunch, follow him on Twitter. Thank you, Sonny. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Joined now on Friday by Doug LaMaurice, co-host along with Shahan Jeharaja of the College Football Survivor Show podcast, which is much listened after the big Alabama-Georgia football game. Good morning, Doug. Good Friday to you.
Hey, Hugh. How are you?
I'm good. Now, I am curious. I have not yet listened to the post-game Alabama-Georgia College Football Survivor Show playoff podcast, so don't spoil it for me. I turned the game off at halftime. Did you hear a lot of people turn it off at halftime?
I think I did hear some, especially right. It's a geographical game. It's two teams from the South, and then some people appreciate great defense and some do not. And that was a lot of great defense and not much offense in the first half. And then it flipped after.
And some of us have to go to bed early because we got to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning in California. And so I said, this game is going to be 10 to 9 and I'm done with it. And it turns out to be a spectacular game. So I'm going to relive it through your podcast. I have a technical question about you and Shahan, as well as Buckeye Talk and Orange and Brown Talk. We are going into the winter spring of football. What do you guys do? What's the plan? How are you plotting to continue a very popular series of podcasts when the prime ingredient of the podcast has gone away? The Buckeyes, the Browns, and college football.
Yeah, it certainly changes. I think in some ways it gets even more interesting, though, Hugh, because I like to do sort of big picture step backs. We'll review some old games and talk about that. We rank stuff. That, you know how it is. Sometimes when you aren't beholden to the news of the day, you can actually do some more interesting stuff. So one of our goals on the Survivor Show is maybe to try to talk to as many former members of the College Football Playoff Committee as we can to get inside what it's like to be in that room and study these teams and pick those teams. But we'll definitely do some history stuff and do some big picture stuff about the sports.
Now, this week, they punted on moving to 12 teams. One of my rules of life is don't make easy decisions hard. They have now made an easy decision hard. What is the deal, Doug? Everybody in the country, except the morons running the football playoff system and college presidents, want a 12-team playoff. I don't know what your opinion on this is, but what happened? Why would they even come to that conclusion so quickly?
Yeah, I like the 12-team playoff. I've liked it since even before they floated it last summer. And part of this, you know how this is. It's a PR perception problem because they floated the idea before they actually had an agreement. And the major thing with college football is it is at heart a regional sport that has become nationalized through the playoff. And it's a good thing that it's become nationalized because it helps us get a true champ. But everybody has local interests. Those are sometimes united, sometimes not. And so right now, everybody has a general idea of let's expand, but then their local specific interests as it relates to money, as it relates to expansion, as it relates to TV networks, all that is holding it up. But I do think you have the main thrust of it. They are making what should be an easier decision harder than it needs to be, but that's what happens when you have a sport that becomes a bureaucracy.
Well, what also happens when you have a sport that becomes a bureaucracy is that people dive into the details of regulatory capture. Your Buckeye talk yesterday kept me up very late listening to coaching changes at Ohio State because it's actually fascinating, the life path and career path of college football coaches. And you kind of dug into that yesterday in Buckeye talk. And this is about College Football Survivor Show. Will you be going into that sort of detail in the offseason?
To some degree, I do think, and you've probably heard me say this, Hugh, the assistant coaches in college football are the middle managers of college football. And I think oftentimes they are very replaceable because in the end, you win with a great guy at the top, a great head coach who establishes a way of doing business, and you win with players. You win with the talent on the field. But we are at the point with the head coaches, with the exploding salaries, with how the market is constantly changing, with how a lot of coaches are frustrated by some of the new things happening in college football, and more of them, I think, are going to threaten to go to the NFL. College football depends how you view it. Is that either an interesting time or a very frustrating time right now? Because there's lots of new things that aren't connected that are happening that have effects on each other and unintended consequences. It's good, right? It's good for the players. It's good for the sort of the health of the game, but they're not very good at regulating it because there's nobody in charge in college football. And the coaches making big time money and threatening to move is going to be part of that.
And think about this, Doug. We're also at the Big Bang era of podcasting, and you're riding three rockets. One of them with Shahan and the others with your co-host Nathan and Steven and your other co-hosts at Orange and Brown. And so everything is changing at the same time. So the same dynamics are affecting football, college football, as are affecting podcasting. I find it fascinating just to watch who is rising and falling rather rapidly. Are you aware of that? That it's sort of like the universe of podcasting expanding outward very quickly and you're on three rockets at the same time?
No, I agree with that. Yeah, it is similar, and sometimes there are unintended consequences, because sometimes I look up and I've done 11 or 12 podcasts in 1 week, and I think, whose idea was this? I love doing these shows. Maybe I talk too much.
Keep doing it, Doug. Keep doing it. You provide me my relaxation, and I thank you for it. Go listen to College Football Survivor Show. Also listen to Buckeye Talk, which is the funniest and I think best college football podcast for one team. And, of course, Orange and Brown Talk, because the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl in 2023. I'll be right back, America. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt live from the West Coast on this Friday, January the 14th. Joined by Ronna McDaniel. She is, of course, chairwoman of the Republican National Committee. Good morning, Ronna. How are you?
Good morning. Great to be with you. It must be really early there.
It is. I really love being on the West Coast. I can get my sleep later in the day. I love doing the show this early. Chairwoman McDaniel, it was great to see you when we were both over at the Senate a few weeks back. But since then, you've done a great thing. For many years, I've been like Cato the Elder talking about Carthage. The presidential debate commissions must be destroyed is my version of Carthage must be destroyed. Cartago delenda est. And you destroyed it yesterday, and you are the hero of the hour. Would you tell people, well, let me just put it this way, is the divorce final?
The divorce is not final. We do have some hoops to go through. We've got to get the RNC members to pass a rule change. So that won't actually happen officially till August or spring at the earliest. We have some things to do. But the debate committee that the RNC had voted unanimously that we want to remove ourselves from the Commission on Presidential Debate.
Now, I have many, many grievances, going back to Candy Crowley throwing the 2012 election, yep, to moderators before, to the 2016 rules and the obvious bias to Hillary, to the 2020 cancellation of the debate, to the makeup of the debate moderators in 2020. What broke your back? I mean, what got the committee to finally say, we are done with you, you are a biased arm of the DNC, even if you have some token Republicans on there?
Well, I think for us, it's that the commission had no interest in working with the Republican Party, which represents 74 million voters. And what they've done is they set up a system where we'll only work with the nominee, but by the time the nominee's in place, which is after the convention in 2024, the debates are all set. So they have total control and a total monopoly. And there were three things that were really egregious in 2020. They picked a moderator that worked for Joe Biden. They started debates after a million votes have been cast. We asked them to start debates before early voting starts. And then I think the third is they had members of their commission that were vocally disparaging the Republican candidate and allowed to stay in their role. And so this has been a cushy job for decades. They have a total monopoly. And we said, can you just guarantee us that you won't pick a moderator that worked for the Democrat candidate? They won't even say yes to that.
Who is the moderator who worked for Biden, would you remind people?
It was Steve Scully.
And Steve is a friend of mine. I think he's a very fine journalist, but they should not have overlooked that detail.
No, and that should be for both. By the way, would the Democrats say Kayleigh McEnany can host the debate for any Democrat? I mean, you shouldn't have an employee of one of the candidates, a former employee, host the debate. It's just not fair. These are really simple asks that we had, Hugh. I think most Americans would say, yeah, debate should start before early voting. You shouldn't have a moderator that worked for the other debate. Yes, the commission that's supposed to be nonpartisan shouldn't have members disparaging either candidate.
It was a very anti-Trump debate commission, and that's okay with the legacy media. It's not okay with America. I also want to point out, Beltway capture is a real deal. And legacy media capture is a real deal. And the presidential debate commissions have been captured both by Beltway confirmation bias and acceptance rewards and by legacy media. So they ran it for the networks and they ran it so that they would get along well at the White House correspondents' dinner. That's what they ran it for.
Well, and they said that to us in no uncertain terms. We do not care about what the RNC says. We do not care about what 74 million voters say. All we're asking for is a free forum, a free and fair forum to let our candidate showcase his policies or her policies. And they can't even give us that guarantee. And it's very clear they don't have any allegiance to the American people and the voters. It's all about them and the media and the D.C. Beltway. And they say, we're not going to do anything with you. We don't care what you say. Even if we've done the most egregious things, we won't even say to you, of course, that makes common sense that we will agree that we won't do those things.
They also make a lot of money off of this.
They make a lot of money.
I wish people would investigate as they cover this story. The salaries of the go to the 990. Just look up the 990 and you'll see what people are paid. But that doesn't begin to scratch what the side gigs are.
Paid for a debate, three debates that happen every 4 years. I mean, it is.
Oh, they've built an empire. Oh, they built an empire. Classic Beltway capture. So tell me what your enforcement mechanism is, because what they're going to do is lay back and pray that the legacy media pounds on whoever the RNC's nominee is and makes them play. So how are you going to prevent that capture?
I want to make it very clear. We want debate. We know that our candidate, when they talk about their policies in a free forum that's transparent, we win. That's why the Democrats need bias, right? Because they know we win, too, when we talk about what we stand for without a biased moderator or the media spinning things. So we're going to look at a couple things. One, we'll look at just negotiating directly with the Democrat candidate, with the networks. We're going to this now opens the door for other entities to come forward and say, hey, we'll host the debate. Remember, Hugh, senators and governors and candidates across the country are debating every year, and they don't need a commission to arrange that.
I've already hosted one Ohio Senate debate, one Minnesota governor's debate. I'm about to do another Senate and another gubernatorial debate.
Did the commission have to arrange it?
No.
So this, what's happened is they have created themselves as a middleman, and they've shown bias throughout the process, only towards Republicans. And then they've created a monopoly. And we're saying we're taking the middleman out, and we're going to look for other forums to showcase our candidate. And the other thing is Donald Trump in 2020 said when they went virtual, I'm going to go do my own forum with Savannah Guthrie. And it did very, very well. So I am not wed to this fact that this Commission on Presidential Debates is the only way we can put our candidate out there, especially when they're consistently biased towards Republicans.
Now, Chairwoman McDaniel, David Bossi is your point man on this, and you selected very well when you put him in charge because he's forgotten more about debates than most people will know. The Republican primary debates are coming up for 2024. I want you to start them early because they'd make money for the party and they would generate audience and they would help us win in 2022 if some of our would-be candidates who are not yet declared got together and kicked it around. Any chance of that happening?
So those rules are being written right now as well. So the debate committee, Dave's in charge of it. There's a subcommittee on primary debates. They met yesterday, and we will be submitting our rule proposals to the full committee to be voted on in August. So we're just putting the procedures in place, and then we'll know what they are by the end of the year. And then
do they have a Hugh Hewitt paragraph in them that Hugh must be involved in every debate?
The Hugh Hewitt Amendment, yes.
Yeah. Now just make sure David knows that that is like Rule 1A4, which is Hugh Hewitt must be on every panel.
You should host all the debate committee members for a nice little round table.
I've been lobbying forever, and they know that. But I'm showing how it can be done. But I really want to stress the importance of why you're doing this. It's because the American people deserve a fair viewing, and they don't need questions from the left, by the left, for the left, which is what we have had for almost 16 years.
Exactly. And, I mean, let's just rewind history. Candy Crowley, Donna Brazile giving a question to Hillary Clinton, the commission picking a moderator that worked for Joe Biden in 2020. It's egregious. And it's time for us to stand up for our candidate because they're not going to be able to stand up for themselves by the time the process plays out. So this is our only opportunity to do that.
And
so
you know, Rana, if they were interested in saving the commission, they would have tendered a collective resignation and asked the RNC and the DNC to name new leadership. But they can't because they've got financial interests.
It's exactly right. And they would have said, you know, I mean, we were very cordial with them, Hugh. We've been working with them for a year. This has not been a quick decision or a rash decision. We tried to get them to just agree on very common sense things. Nothing we've asked is crazy. I don't think any Democrat on the street would say, oh, yeah, it's crazy that they picked a, you know, it's okay that they picked a moderator that works for Joe Biden. It's okay that they start debates after many, many states started voting. Most people agree with that. So why are they so reticent? Because power is the issue. It's not about the American people. And that's what debates should be about, the American people.
Has it struck you that Frank Fahrenkopf, who did yeoman's work back when he was my age, which is a couple of decades ago, which ought to tell the audience something, that Frank Fahrenkopf has the Fauci and Biden problem, which is really, when you're an octogenarian, you ought not to be making decisions about important issues?
Yeah, I met with Frank many times. I really thought Frank listened and understood and was empathetic to the issue, being a former RNC chair. And the reason he started this commission was because of the bias from the League of Women Voters that had had such a control on the debates, and they have created the exact same entity. And by the way, there's no transparency. And you know what, Republicans, we don't like monopolies. We don't like situations where there's no competition in the marketplace.
You get the gold star for GOP chair people. No going back? Question mark. Ronna McDaniel, no going back?
No going back.
I appreciate that so much. Cartago Delenda asked, in this case, the Presidential Debate Commission must be destroyed. Thank you, Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel. Don't go anywhere, America. Lots more ahead on the Hugh Hewitt Show. America, and I uphold my ends of wagers lost even when the referees combine with the Green Bay Packers to deny the Browns their rightful place in the playoffs on Christmas Day when the Browns lost 24-22 on a missed call by the referees that everyone in America saw in the final drive. But I had a bet with Congressman Mike Gallagher, and so I am attired now, if you're watching on the Salem News Channel, as Congressman Gallagher joins us, with a cheesehead Green Bay Packer glasses, a very, very moldy jacket, and a somewhat odoriferous T-shirt, all full of Green Bay Packer regalia. You know, I know Mark Murphy, the president of the Packers. We could get you some new stuff, Congressman.
No, you don't want to wash those clothes because then you wash the good juju out of it, Hugh. But you look great. You look really good. This is a good look for you. You should wear this every week.
So you would agree I have indeed satisfied the terms of the bet?
Well, there's some debate about this because if I would actually – I'd like Dwayne to pull up the original clip because I believe the terms of the bet as stated by you, noted constitutional lawyer Hugh Hewitt – was that it was not just wearing it for 1 week. It was for every week until the season was done. That's my recollection of the initial
conversation. We have lost that tape, but I believe my best recollection is that, in fact, we don't have to actually do anything except wear it, right? So we don't...
I'm sensing some lawyering coming up here.
Well, if you're watching the feed... you'll see, I still have everything on, right?
I see you wearing everything.
Yes.
On my feed. Yeah, oh, so, you're not going to broadcast this.
Oh, no, it's being broadcast live right now. I can't help it that the lights have failed in the studio and that the camera angle has changed. I'm doing my job like the referees did their job. Sort of.
I'm now getting this on my camera, so the world will note long after this is over that it happened.
Oh, wait
you
a minute.
You cannot evade this.
I need you to get the real thing then. Bring the camera back because I don't want him out there saying I didn't live up to my deal.
Hey, Congressman, check your texts.
Yeah, okay. We got other. Hey, look, Congressman, you will admit, I went out with John Yeager, my law partner and dear friend of 30 years. He's a Packers nut. He goes to Lambeau like you do. He doesn't live there, but he goes there all the time. Grew up on the Packers. He admitted the call was blown. Will you at least admit that the call was blown?
I admit nothing. I give no quarter to Packers. You or any other Browns fan. The only thing that was blown was your entire season. The only thing that was blown was the decision to draft Baker Mayfield in the first place. How is Baker Mayfield on every TV commercial out there? I mean, for a mediocre quarterback to have that many endorsements, I do not understand what is going on.
Generally agreed that Baker Mayfield is the best athlete on TV, as opposed to your stiff Aaron Rodgers, who's also getting a little bit. Well, let's not go there. I need to actually. By the way, I have a note here. The gracious Congressman Gallagher included in the shipment that must go back to him under pain of death of Dwayne. Hugh, this is what victory looks like. Enjoy it for a change, Mike Gallagher. That's going to sit here until the next millennium, if necessary, when we can have a Browns victory. Congressman, even though you can revel in this, and you can, and we'll do this forever, I have to ask you about something very serious. This morning, Ukraine is subject, the breaking news story is that the Ukraine is, may I take this off to talk about a serious subject with you?
Yes.
All right.
I'll allow it.
All right. The Ukraine is under a serious cyber attack this morning across all their major platforms, all their industries. What do you think that portends?
I think it portends an invasion. I would call this preparation of the battle space right now. And I also, we've heard reports out there that Jake Sullivan has said the intel community has information which suggests Russia is laying the groundwork to fabricate a pretext for invading Ukraine. So, you know, this is actually an important point because it's something that I think will become increasingly relevant in Taiwan. We're almost guaranteed to see aggressive disinformation that will allow Russia to justify an invasion. And it may seem absurd from a Western perspective, but putting false things online out there, using deepfake technology to suggest things are happening on the ground that didn't happen, it's just enough to create confusion, to delay our response, or to fracture a unified response from the West, or give countries that really don't want to get involved enough of a fig leaf not to get involved. Now, think about that in the Taiwan context, right? If the CHICOMs made a move on Taiwan, what would you likely see? Well, Klon Kitchen at AEI has done some really good work on this. You'd probably see deepfake technology showing President Tsai surrendering in order to confuse the international community, or showing PLA soldiers securing the presidential compound just to delay our response. And again, it doesn't need to be 100% believable or effective to work. It just needs to delay our response so that we can't surge forces forward in time. And I think you're starting to see the same thing on the ground here in Ukraine. I mean, Putin's demands were completely unreasonable. The Biden administration is clinging to this foolish approach that just the threat of sanctions after the fact is somehow going to deter Putin. And more to the point, yesterday, what did we see in the Senate? We saw Senate Democrats, the same ones who for 4 years lectured Republicans as being soft on Russia, who tried to portray former President Donald Trump as a puppet of Russia, override Republicans' attempt to impose sanctions for the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So this is a gift to Russia, and all of these things conspire, I think, in my mind, to make a conflict more inevitable.
Congressman, the United States has sent Deputy Secretary of State Wendy, what do you want next from America, Sherman, over to negotiate. She's the one that negotiated in part the 1994 giveaway to North Korea, the 2016 giveaway to Iran. She is a disaster at the negotiating table because she's a pushover. She's just a mark. And so it's like a signal that we're going to lose when you send Deputy Secretary Sherman anywhere. My question is, remember the Wehrmacht dropped German soldiers dressed as Polish soldiers into Poland prior to the Blitzkrieg of Poland in the beginning stages of World War II. This is clearly what's going on. Do you believe that the United States and NATO now has sufficient, with these cyber attacks this morning, has sufficient cause to spy, as we say in the international law of war community, to strike back in cyber terms against the assets of Putin and his cronies that are held abroad and disintermediate them from their owners?
Yes, 100%. First of all, Hugh, though, you think I can't read the Chiron here, which says, gloating Packers fan? Where is that in the terms of the bet? That's violating
the spirit of the bet. I have no control over the Chiron.
I don't know. 100%. You know, one thing that really concerns me is we've made huge advances in cyber in the last 5 years, and General Nakasone and his team have really sped up the decision-making cycle, the so-called OODA loop, through which we approve and conduct offensive cyber operations, but we're still too slow. And more to the point, there are rumors right now that the Biden administration is actually going to make it more difficult in order to get offensive cyber ops approved by adding more people into the decision-making process. That would be a massive mistake. We need to be doing this on a routine basis, and we especially need to be doing this in the specific context of Ukraine. And there's a theory out there that we shouldn't because cyber is inherently escalatory. That's totally bogus. And just look at the fact that Russia and China are constantly conducting cyber operations against us, and it's not devolving or escalating into nuclear war. So absolutely, we need to, if we don't already have robust what's called defend forward teams out there working with the Ukrainians, we need to surge more there immediately. Again, another thing that will be relevant in a Taiwan context, we need to increase our cyber cooperation with Taiwanese defense forces as well. So absolutely, I believe we have enough of a pretext to do it, and we have more capabilities that we can bring to bear on this fight.
Do you know the left mocks what they do not want to happen? Yesterday, John Cornyn on this show suggested reinvigorating Lend-Lease for the Ukraine, and the left mocked it. I've suggested in the Washington Post that if there are gaps in the Virginia teaching system, they ought to use retired military veterans, including especially officers, to fill classrooms on a temporary basis. They mock that idea. They mock what they do not understand. I think we have to be deadly serious, though, about a related threat. Iran is threatening dozens of Americans, And Jake Sullivan, God bless him, has said, we will crush you if you hit an American at home. Any of those people who are being threatened. I think Iran and all of our enemies are watching Ukraine right now and are drawing lessons about the infirmities of the Biden administration in response to the Ukraine attack. Do you believe that our enemies around the world are watching right now what we do vis-a-vis Ukraine's vulnerability?
They're absolutely watching, just as they watched our ignominious surrender and botched withdrawal in Afghanistan. And then in some cases, in the case of the Chinese Communist Party, explicitly used it as a propaganda weapon in order to weaken the resolve of some of our allies and cause them to question America's willingness to fight and alongside them and defend their interests as well as our own interests. So absolutely, they're watching. And as it pertains to Iran, something to watch that really concerns me. If you follow the Iranian press, there's been some gloating coming out of the regime right now, which suggests to me that there may be an interim agreement, sort of a half resuscitation of the JCPOA that we can expect soon, which would be an absolute disaster.
They're going to release another tranche of billions of dollars in sequestered funds, and Wendy Sherman's going to blame Donald Trump for that. It's real. I see it rolling out. They're just setting up the giveaway, and they're going to blame Donald Trump because they're weak.
100%. I mean, it's surrender Sherman. It's Keystone Kerry. It's the same crew that gave us the Iran deal and a disastrous Obama foreign policy. They're trying to bring it back to life. As I've said on your show before, we're conducting a unique experiment of sort of fusing Bernie Sanders' domestic policy to Barack Obama's foreign policy. That is a toxic mix. And I really do think this week we saw just the absolute low point, if not the end, of the Biden presidency.
Oh, I agree.
With his ridiculous speech in Atlanta, thank God Senator Sinema is standing firm on principle on the filibuster. She and Joe Manchin, I think, deserve enormous credit for that. But it's rock bottom for the
Biden. If you read Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal today, and when you've lost Peggy Noonan, she is the center right sort of plumb line of moderate center right conservatism. And she's a rhetorician of great skill. And she devastated the president's speech, as did everybody on the floor. McConnell, Cotton. Rubio, they all just took the president made a strategic error, Mike Gallagher. I want to give you the last minute. Running into 2022, I don't want to be talking about election reform. I don't want to be talking about anything except the weakness at home and abroad, the incoherence at home and abroad of the Democrats. You and Ron Johnson got together when Senator Johnson declared his almost inevitable reelection campaign. What do you think 2022 ought to be about? I think it ought to be about national security because we're getting crushed.
Well, I do think it's a referendum on the failed policies, the radically progressive policies of the Biden administration, and the fact that he mistook a narrow election victory and a historically close makeup of Congress for some mandate for radical progressive change. Two, the complete collapse of American deterrence and the proliferation of threats around the world. Yes, national security. But three, at a local level, you know, I think basic public safety, and the failure of our educational system are what matters. We saw in Virginia, though, that is what is going to matter to people. So
do I have to send this back to you? You got 30. You got 10 seconds.
You know,
the
only thing I care about is the vest, Hugh. I want the vest back. You can keep the rest of it.
This smells bad. It smells like it's been around a lot of sweaty pants.
It's got a lot of beer on it, Hugh.
Congressman Mike Gallagher, my debt to society is paid. Congratulations, even though a man of honor might have said, no, not with that call. I won't take it. Thank you, Congressman.
Way across the universe.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt live on the West Coast, joined by Charlie Dombeck of Key City Capital. They're a great sponsor of the show, keycitycapital.com/Hugh. Charlie, I want to talk to you about inflation, but first I want to talk to you about the fact that you've had kind of a very surprising to me. I knew you would be of appeal to my audience, but a whole bunch of my audience have contacted you. And I know my audience is highly educated, largely affluent homeowners, but some of them don't, you know, they're still working and they've got kids. 70% of my audience have children in the house. Why are people reaching out to keycitycapital.com/you? What are they telling you?
Well, they share the same concerns that all of us have about what's happening politically in our country, as well as what's happening economically. And so the issues that we're raising resonate directly with our audience. And if you think about it, with the issues that we're facing with inflation and continuing to print money and a Build Back America plan, those issues are going to directly affect our audience immediately. And we're already seeing the effects of the continued inflation, the change in the market cycle. So your audience is dealing with troubling issues and are understanding the message that we're conveying.
They also have accumulated wealth over a lifetime. Many of them are, I would guess most of the people reaching out to you are over 40, and I'll bet you a majority are over 50, maybe even over 55, and they have retirement accounts, and they do not want to see the lifetime work that they've accumulated for their children and grandchildren destroyed by inflation. So they're looking for that proverbial unicorn, growth and income. I don't know the answer. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. And think about it. The last thing that people who have accumulated their wealth that have moved to a passive income lifestyle want to suffer from is a 30% correction in the market like we saw in the subprime crisis back over a decade ago. And so people are worried about that. And the audience that is directly affected by what is happening today is people that are at or are near retirement age, because they're living on a fixed income lifestyle, right? And if you think about inflation, inflation potentially erodes your purchasing power because you're living off of a fixed income.
So what I've told my kids, I've got three successful kids. They're all working. Two of them are married. They can afford two or three market shocks in their life. They just can't afford a market shock after 70. And they really ought to be defensive after 60 and begin to move towards a defensive strategy to preserve whatever they accumulate if they want to give it to their children. And so when they call you, there's not an offer to sell securities. What's the first thing you do? A tax audit with them. You go through their taxes to get back what they've overpaid. But then how do you educate people, and what kind of investment ought people to be thinking? I think it's six figures, right?
I do. The first thing that we do, of course, is a planning process. And we look at two things. One is the low-hanging fruit in terms of what can we do to help clients recover dollars they're unnecessarily paying in state and federal income taxes. And then we do a complete audit of our client's portfolio and actually look at each individual investment in their portfolio and benchmark that against the industry standard for that class of investments. And then we look at how should your capital be allocated given the current market environment that we're in today. And as we see this morning by just simply reading the Wall Street Journal that completely covered the inflation landscape, what should we be doing with our portfolio in terms of rebalancing? There's things in your portfolio that you had maybe in the third and fourth quarter that you should probably not have today, given what's happening.
But I want to stress, Charlie, if they don't want to go open kimono with you, and there are a lot of people who don't for a lot of reasons, you will nevertheless assist them in investing chunks of money if they want to diversify their risk allocated portfolio. Am I right?
Absolutely. And we always talk about real estate that we sponsor here at Key City Capital. We raised rental rates across our portfolio 6% on average on January 1. We are seeing shelter inflation. Rental real estate is probably the best hedge today against inflation. And that's the area that we specialize in and work in, and that's how we help people grow their wealth.
I noticed that. It was shelter inflation that drove that 7% number, both housing and rental. And I think rental is going to be even worse than housing had the huge bump last year. I think rental's going to have the huge bump this year. Do you agree with me?
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
I like being absolutely right, Charlie. So to get Charlie and his team, go to keycitycapital.com/Hugh. Who will they first contact with, Charlie? People like to know who they're talking to.
They're going to speak either directly with myself or Steven Patterson, who is an analyst on my team. And oftentimes they will be greeted by Donna, who is probably the most friendly woman you will ever meet. So she will answer your phone call, and she'll put you directly in touch with myself or Steven Patterson.
You are such a great sponsor, and I know my audience is just overwhelming you with interest, and I'm glad that's what happens with the Hugh Hewitt audience when people come on and do this. A sponsored segment this is, but boy, it's informative. KeyCityCapital.com/Hugh. KeyCityCapital.com/Hugh. Charlie Dombeck, good to speak with you. Don't go anywhere, America. Dr. Larry Arnn in the Hillsdale Dialogue, along with Dean Stephen Smith. We continue the Bard's Dance with us across the ages. Hour number three of the Friday Hugh Hewitt Show, straight ahead live from the West Coast, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.